The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
I find adventurous experiences are the great equalizer. Doesn't matter what group you're working with, physically adept, mental acuity, whatever it might be, it brings them into that level of equality. I think if we can just get rid of this notion of hierarchical nature and bring them into experience where they can learn the most from, then that is always going to be the richest outcomes that we can have.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Phil Brown. Phil and I were just talking about his role and titles. He's got a couple, but experiential and adventure education. That's a really interesting space that we'll be diving into today. And he also is the host of a podcast called The Vertical Playpen, which Phil tells me has just hit 300 episodes. So I'm pretty amped to go and check out some of those too. So welcome to the show, Phil.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dane.
You bet. You bet. It's been fun just bouncing around with a fellow Brit. I do actually have a British passport, so I can say that.
We'll accept you.
Thanks. Well, you did in 2004, so I don't know how you can kick me out now.
I know.
some shared philosophies, shared experiences. Tell us a little bit more about how you came to be doing the work you're doing today, Phil.
Yeah, so I started in public school education. So that was my degree. That was what I was getting into. I wanted to teach. And this was in England. And I had this like realization that what would be great for my professional development if I wanted to be a really good teacher is travel the world and interact with different kids of different cultures and backgrounds. I made it to one country and then I stayed here for 20 years. So I'm still on that journey. I came to the States. So I'm based in Vermont in the US. And I actually, my initial entry was in New York State. I went to a summer camp. I worked there for a summer. And that was the intent, to try to build up that resume. Like, let's work with some summer camp kids. Let's experience the culture there. And then I'll take that back to the UK. And I just kind of fell in love with just working outdoors. That was my initial step in. I thought this was just going to be seasonal. I ended up staying there for 7 years at that one site. They did year-round programming. And they leveraged the fact that I had a teaching degree, so I started teaching outdoor education. So it was bringing school groups into that environment in upstate New York. And I would take those kids, and we would teach so many different aspects of the outside environment, education, pond ecology, survival classes. Like, it was a gamut. Like, you became the jack of all trades. But the thing that I really resonated with the most was the team aspect. We would do a small section of team building. It was like team building light. But really just connecting people. And I kind of really enjoyed that aspect of it. I enjoyed the benefit of doing something like that, like the benefit to me as an educator, the benefit to me working with students, the benefit to the students. I started to interact with the educators and do that. And then slowly I kept getting worked into different programming where I would work with corporate groups and I would work with different intact teams, sports teams. And I just kind of fell in love with the idea of doing team dynamics instead of working in pure education with youth. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I just kept following that train of like, this is where I want to go. This is the stuff I get excited about. And as an educator, that my intent was like, how do I make life better for the students I work with? But I actually realized that the best way for me to do that was to actually spend time working on team development rather than working on, let's say, at the time I was doing English, so it would be like Shakespeare. Like, yeah, I could teach Shakespeare, and in the doing so, I could teach about humanity. Sure, I can line that in. But wouldn't it be better if I just taught humanity? Like that, wouldn't it be better if I could just get to the root of the people? And then through lots of searching my own, falling into the job, going to conferences, presenting, speaking to other folks doing some form of team development in different realms, I realized the combination of creating an adventurous experience, so taking a group into an experience that's unique and new to them, would like increase the potential that I could make a difference. And so I could create bigger experiences, bigger learning opportunities. And so that kind of merge of outdoors, working with teams led me to doing team development with experiential, now adventure education. And that's what now I, now my role is I teach that to other educators. So I do very limited direct service, and I now do the teaching of others, which aligns to something we were talking off the recording, was just that notion of as you age into a career, suddenly people start asking you for advice, and you realize oh, I have a duty to maybe give some advice. And you think, am I the right person to give it? And then you start to catalog all the experience you've had and said, well, 20 years is quite a long time. So maybe it holds some weight. And evidently it is.
Yeah. That's brilliant. I didn't realize that you and I also had the same linkage there, which is that we went traveling around the world, started in the USA and stopped. So that was part of what brought me here too. And this whole premise of, you know, being outdoors, teaching people in an experiential way to lift, I love the way you talk about it as teaching humanity, but to lift that connection, that teamwork. There must have been something about that that just grabbed you. Can you think back on what that was?
Yeah, I remember being trained on how to operate a zip line. And I remember sitting on the platform, and it was, at the time, it was a very basic concept of like that we'd get participants up to me and I would talk to them, and then they would go talk to them and they would go off the platform. And I realized that the interaction, the ability for someone to be willing to step up onto a platform, climb a ladder or something up to a platform on belay, so on a rope, get them to the platform, have them attached to a zip and then go off, that there was a lot of pre-work and work in the moment that I needed to do to allow that to happen. And it was not simply just be there. And I think that initially when I teach adventure programming, in any way, if we're ever trying to get people to step into, in my world, we call it the challenge zones. So there's the central bucket, which is the circle of comfort. There's another circle of challenge. And then there's an exterior circle, if you're thinking of like a bullseye image, of panic. So my role is to try to get them in that challenge somewhere, not creep them into panic, and not necessarily be smack bang in the middle of comfort. So there's the challenge zone. We often talk about being the largest area of learning and growth. But like, in order to get them to that, I can't just simply be, because nobody is ever coming into a program comfortable. No one's ever going to start climbing onto a platform comfortable, regardless of if they say they've done it a million times before. And I need to do the groundwork of creating connection and trust, giving clear choice, giving empowerment to them as individuals in order for them to go up, and then equally then be able to step off or scoot off of the platform and give themselves over to the zip experience.
Yeah.
And when I talk to a lot of newer professionals who have similar experiences, they'll often say, like, I don't get many people who want to climb. And I think that a large part of that is not doing all that pre-work. So the shift for me was, if I ever expect anyone to take any form of risk, doesn't have to be in the form of stepping off a platform, but could be what is probably one of the hardest risks in the human experience, which is public speaking or advocating for yourself. If I want people to do that, then I need to do the groundwork, the pre-work for that too. So kind of just reinforced that for me, of the importance of doing the pre-work, and got me super excited about the human part of it, regardless of the zip. I think, you know, people get, when I get listed as an adventure educator or an adventure trainer or something like that, I think people get hung up on the word adventure and assume that I'm doing skydiving or whitewater rafting or what they might see as an adventure sport. But the way that I define adventure comes into three categories. Mm-hmm. The first is, it's a unique experience, something that you've not done before. Something, and it can be novel, unique, novel. The second is risk involved, and that could be physical, but it could quite easily be emotional. Social risk is involved.
Yeah.
And then there's an educational outcome, some learning that you get from it. And if you combine all three, then you have an adventurous experience. So I think I put out to the listeners, if you're thinking, when was the most recent adventure that you've done, just consider what was novel and unique, what was potentially risky, and what was a learning outcome. And it could be as simply as, you know, if you've got kids every day working with them, You know, like there is interactions that you have on the everyday that is adventurous. And I think that we, by adding a huge label to it and putting it really at this pedestal, we forget that we are experiencing adventures every day. And that's what I get to do as an educator, is remind people of that and then craft the learning experiences out of that.
That's brilliant. That's very cool. I love the unique, the risk and the educational learning outcome. And it is fascinating, to your earlier point, that the pre-work matters, the connection and the trust. I was listening to a good friend of mine, Gary Ridge, on Simon Sinek's podcast the other day. And Gary was the CEO of WD-40. And he was talking about the journey he took over 25 years there as a leader. And that, you know, when a leader sets a strategy, just like an adventure guide might set an adventure, that the team isn't going to come along with the strategy unless you build those relationships. And what I thought was great, and you've shared it in the same way, what was great about Gary's point for leaders out there is, hey, if you build a cool strategy and maybe a professor gives you 70 out of 100, but then only 20% of your team come along on the adventure, which is work, because they are taking social risks and doing different things, then really you're landing at what, like a 14% efficacy for your adventure. Whereas if you can do the pre-work and bring more of the team into the connection and the trust, then as you go out to execute that strategy, if you're hitting 80 or 90% of the team on the journey with you, now you're at 56 or 60%, and now you're actually moving. And I'm hearing a lot of that from your experience and philosophy.
It was something I was reading. So I do a lot of, because I work in the adventure world, I have to serve on a lot of risk management committees, and I talk about risk in a great way. I was doing a class on wilderness first responders, and I was just talking to them about, you know, doing the pre-work, and it could be in a very simple way of like prepping a bag before you leave. But the analogy I was bringing out, and it's also about the mental ability for us, is it used to be that first aid kits used to have in them, and this is pre-1950s, but in a first aid kit used to be a cigarette. So of course now we would consider, like, of course you wouldn't have a cigarette around medical stuff, but the purpose of the cigarette was not for the person that you were rescuing. It was for the first aider themselves.
Yes.
So you would open up your first aid kit, and before you engaged in anything else, before you assessed the person who was in need, before you arrived on the scene, you would pull out the cigarette, you would take the cigarette and you would smoke it. You would smoke it until it's done, and then you would respond. And the concept of that was you were doing a lot of the mental pre-work to allow yourself to be in the moment when you arrived. And so I think about that lots when I do adventurous experiences. If you aren't allowing them to smoke their cigarette, but like just have that moment of calm, if you rush into an experience, if I'm going to set something for you and I'm immediately setting something up, then you're going to create a stressful experience because you're not allowing that pre-work. It's over in the connection, but it could be in just the awareness of what's coming. It's the same reason when I do a lot of team development work now, I'm very clear on the agenda. Like, I'm going to give them a bare bones agenda. I'm not going to give them specific things that we do, but at least know when the lunch is going to be, when the start is going to be, when there's going to be a break. Because if you don't do that, you don't do that little bit of cigarette smoking for them, they're going to have a constant concern of what's coming next.
And yes.
I don't think the need for adventure needs to be unknown outcomes.
Yeah.
Adventurous, for me, it might be like I'm going to guide a group and I don't know what's going to happen. And that's my role, but I don't need to let that onto the participants. I need them to have the moment to be in the moment and experience it. Yeah.
It's such a great framework, particularly now in the workplace when so many teams are burdened by, oh my gosh, we've got 15 new tools we need to work with. And the outside world's chaotic and AI is coming in. So I don't actually know what my job's going to be in 12 months. Like, now beyond any other time in history, I believe teams need that cigarette moment. They need a bit of time to process through what am I coming into right now. And I love your kind of high level agenda. Just take the uncertainty out of it. We're going to work through till this time and stop for lunch. And the objective of the day is X. Like, I think so many teams are just thrust into another day, another week, another quarter with so little of that clarity.
And I think that from a leadership perspective, I think sometimes the withholding of information feels like it's a protective thing. Like, oh, if I hold back on this, I don't want to scare people by revealing that so-and-so this quarter didn't financially meet our budget. If I don't set them up, it'll be better. But what actually happens for individuals, as we know as being individuals ourselves, is we fill in all of the gap of knowledge with negativity. The worst outcomes are what flood our minds. So if we can do the best to just be honest and authentic and give that to our participants and those we work with, then that solves that stress and they can be themselves in the moment.
What is it, Phil, that makes you say that the gap, because I'm very aware of the gap, but why is it that negativity is what fills the gap by default?
I think this is where I get into this, you know, what can we do better in the future mentality. Is I think that the gap is because that's what's happened before. We are as human beings, we're predictive engines. We're predictive computers. Yeah. We go based on previous experience. If the last time you weren't told something, the thing you weren't told was a negative outcome, guess what? Every time you receive that now, you're going to lean towards that same result. So, you know, I'm always filling in the gap. And the gaps should ultimately, and that's, you know, and I know it when I have a good leader, and I've gotten listeners thinking of different people in your life who've been really good leaders, you know that when they said the door is open, they actually meant it. Because they had a track record of every time you went to them, they responded. Yep. And if that continues in someone's life, then that is that's the prediction that they'll make in their mind. So they will always come up with positive. They'll fill it with positive because every single time it was.
Yeah.
The problem is that we just aren't necessarily great at that, or we've experienced moments where that's not been the case. And because that's that, we protect ourselves.
Protection.
You know, if we've got fight, flight, freeze, and fawn, those things that we experience when we go into those moments of panic. And a lot of that is created by previous experiences. We are predictive engines.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Not many of us walk into an environment and go, well, the last time someone didn't share something with me, it worked out awesome.
Yeah. You remember that raise we got out randomly, which was mysterious? That's and everyone right. just, they said, hey, I've got something coming. I'm going to tell you in 2 weeks. And it turned out we have a raise and a promotion.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. That's very cool. So as you think through, like, you've designed the experience, you do the pre-work, and then you get the team out there on this adventure and they're taking the risks. What is it that you've seen that really bucks conventional wisdom? That's like, hey, this, when teams get together in this moment, they're out there, they can't like opt out, like take themselves off camera and go and make themselves a tea. Like, they're in there doing it. What is it that you have seen that surprised you about the way that these teams build their connection and their effectiveness?
Yeah, I call it the shared experience, which just means that, like, no matter what, and this is the bucking of the trend is really the amount of lack of control I truly have as someone who might lead an experience. Yeah. I think when new people start doing the work that I do, you have outcomes that you're expecting. One of those might be, and this is a very classic experience if you've ever worked with school groups, a teacher might say to you, hey, Phil, this class is coming and so-and-so kids have this and this and this. And it's often ADHD because they're disruptive in the classroom. We get the exact same thing if I'm working with a corporate group, if I'm having a senior member of staff come and tell me and they're like, hey, just so you know, this person here might so-and-so.
Yeah.
When you bring a group into an experience that is intrinsically motivating, which essentially is you have choice, you have control, there's challenge. If you have... And fun, you know, like there's intentionality around play. Like I have a light behind me. It says play because I do play-based learning is one of my methodologies. But when you take a group that would be otherwise in their home environment, you take them into a unique experience, they very often surprise you in the best way. It's very infrequent that people devolve to a lesser state of themselves and bring out the worst. That can happen through maybe poor guidance in taking people to stressful experiences they weren't prepared for. But yeah. I often can, it's a good thing to see those sometimes. But for me, I think it's the shared experience of just being in a unique environment together. That's that uniqueness that always bears more fruit than if I come into your environment. So, you know, very often I get brought in and I'm coming into someone's environment and I try my best to shake it up. Like if I've got like desks in a row, I ask everyone to push the chairs to the side and tables to the side, make an open space. Like I try to make their experience different. But when they come out to us, I'm in Vermont and I have the luxury of a beautiful wooded area with an incredible environment that you can bring them to if you come out to us here in Brattleboro. But it's the unique experience that galvanizes a group. I'll give you a prime example, and this is not me. I'm trying not to like highlight, look how cool I am because I worked with a really fun group. But I just want to highlight that in 2011, the company I worked with the Boston Bruins. So the NHL team, we've become somewhat like an unofficial NHL team development team because we had success. That year that they worked with us, they won the Stanley Cup. So like we've got a good like, and then we worked with a German team in Germany and then they won their version of the Stanley Cup that same time. So, and it wasn't, you know, it's not like, well, what magic did you do? There's nothing particularly magical about connecting people in an environment, but I find adventurous experiences are the great equalizer. Doesn't matter what group you're working with, physically adept, mental acuity, whatever it might be, it brings them into that level of equality. You get everyone to an extent. You can't predict who's going to be nervous at height. You can't be predicting who's going to be nervous doing what so and so. And it's this. And when we do those, when we do those programs, if it's the Bruins, or a corporate group, or educators, everyone's a part of it. So we don't. It's the coaching staff. It's all of them, and we have everyone on the same level playing field. We don't. There's no hierarchy.
Yeah.
And when you can do a shared experience where there's no hierarchy, you get to see the best in people because it just re-highlights the humanity. A senior member of staff isn't more or less than a newer employee that's come into your location in terms of being a human being. They just have more experience maybe in the role. And so I think if we can just get rid of this notion of hierarchical nature and bring them into experience where they can learn the most from, then that is always going to be the richest outcomes that we can have. So I wouldn't say it's like most groundbreaking. For me, it makes sense. But like, I think when I talk to people, they think, well, what would be the benefit of going somewhere else? Why can't you just come? And I think that the benefit to going to a different experience is the benefit that they just don't know until you get there. And they start to see each other in people's in different environments.
I love that example. And it's fascinating that you got to work with those like high performing teams. Cause you think about those guys, you're like, well, they've got the best strength and conditioning and coaching and strategy and equipment and they're training. But there's one thing that it's really hard to train for, which is that connection, that understanding and appreciation of each other. And I think that time again shows up in the winning sports teams, but it's something you have to work on consistently. It's not like you do it once and you've got it. It's in the bottle.
It's a systemic and holistic, like it's all the way through top to bottom. I don't know if you've read, and I encourage your listeners to read if they haven't, a book called Legacy.
Okay.
And I'm blanking on the author's name, but it's the concept is it's looking at the New Zealand All Blacks. And so you will be aware of them, but maybe Americans might not be, but New Zealand All Blacks are the winningest sports team in all of sports history.
Yeah.
And what this book follows is it followed them as a cultural experience, not just as like the team. Yes, you can get the most physically abled people, but I think that the winning piece, the puzzle piece that often teams miss is the connection. And that's the work that we do. And that's why we advocate for the work in such a big way that's so important, but it's a hard untangible. I can measure your CO2 outputs in your I can measure your physicality, your muscular, your fast twitch fiber muscles, all that kind of stuff. But I can't. There's no number that says this is the target number of connection you're trying to reach. Oh, your connection's a zero or a 0.5. We need to get to a 0.6. It's an untangible. It's often the thing that changes between a winning team and a losing team is the way that they connect. And this book highlights one particular subject area that I really enjoy. It's called one topic. It's called Sweeping the Sheds.
Oh, I love
and,
that.
And Sweeping the Sheds, for them, the locker room of the New Zealand All Blacks is called the Shed. Now, it works perfectly for us as an adventure educator because I have an actual shed with gear in it and we try to sweep it. But the notion is that nobody in your team is too big to do the little jobs that need to get done.
Yeah.
And for the New Zealand All Blacks, as soon as they win, like they won the World Cup in rugby, the Rugby World Cup, before they can celebrate, go and get their trophy, the coach says, get down to the shed. And all of the players, they clean up after themselves.
Yeah.
They do all their what? They do their laundry. They clean. They don't have anyone do any of that stuff for them. They don't have kit people. You know, like that's their responsibility. And it doesn't matter that they're the players. They own all of the parts that go up to it. And until they do their, you know, chores, essentially, until they do those things that humble them back down to being real human beings, they can't actually go out and connect with people. So they never put them on a pedestal. New Zealand All Blacks are part of the community. The community supports them because they're a part of them. They're one of them. There's no othering feelings. And that culture is what can lead to champion teams because every player cares about the other player.
Yeah.
It's not about like, can I become the best? Can I become the LeBron James? No one cares about like, whereas you get a lot of sports, American sports are pretty bad at this, where they really highlight individual performers, where you have fans who follow players. And that feels alien to me. It probably feels alien to you as an Aussie as well. Like this, me growing up as English, it's like, no, it was sport is community driven first.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that was what lost. So that's a reminder when we go into programming, we just go straight into the connection and almost like the humbling experience of just let's connect as human beings. And I could care less if you're the best player on your team.
That's right.
Yeah,
for me, if I was following a team and a key player went to another team, he's dead to me.
Exactly, as he should be. No, that seems completely appropriate. I don't see anything wrong
with
that.
Oh, LeBron's gone to Cleveland. I'm going to switch out my Miami shirt for a Cleveland shirt.
It feels so bizarre to me. I remember fans of, I'm in the New England area, I'm following Brady. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Why are you following him when he leaves
Tampa.
Patriots?
Like, where is that?
Yeah, why would you follow him?
That is funny. James Kerr was the author. I looked it
James
up for
Kerr.
You there, Phil.
All right, yeah, thank
great
you.
Great book. Apologies, we'll put that in the show notes. It's really interesting, a couple of things that I hear you say there about people's role doesn't matter when you get them in that adventure experience. I've done some cool, nothing overly adventurous, but certainly unique and novel. So light, adventure light.
So adventurous, though, yeah.
Yeah, adventurous. Yeah, right. Exactly. There you go. You've proven
it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So don't try to classify how little your adventure is. An adventure is an adventure, and you did a great job.
I love that. That's such a good point. So we create this adventure, and it's called the Mystery Box. And it's this blue packing crate. I don't know if you've seen it. Blue packing crate with some holes drilled through it and some bent pieces of PVC pipe and a couple of boards. And it kind of... it's like a puzzle, right? And then there's a hula hoop and you have to get the people to come together and look at this box and they can walk around it and they can talk and they can draw pictures and take pictures and they can plan on how they're going to take this box apart, all go through the hula hoop with it and reconstruct it exactly as it was. And you do this multiple times because they have to build a system together of how they're going to do it and what role they're each going to play. And what I find fascinating about the exercise is that where professional teams start and get to on the journey of how many minutes it takes to do it and where kids get to are like quantum leaps apart. Like kids just bang it out and they're getting down into like low minutes and seconds where the professionals get stuck. And I think it's because when they start that exercise, they are deferring to the authorities of their work roles. And that they haven't broken down or taken off some of that corporate armor. And yet there's nothing yet that I've seen that allows you to talk to the team about this is how you need to approach this challenge so that they can perform at the level of some, you know, grade eight kids. So you must see that in some of your work. Like, where are some of the experiences, the beliefs, the approaches that help you kind of take that corporate armor off when you do take a team or professional team, someone's the star player, and get them to, like the New Zealanders do, kind of level out, become humble, be open-minded about how to support each other.
One of my mentors used this phrase of being a chameleon. And it doesn't mean necessarily like letting go of who you are as a human being when I work with a group, but I try my best to assimilate as best as I can into their environment before just going in and changing it all. So if I was working with a group of kids, like something I say to educators all the time, my aim as an educator of children is to not be childish, but be childlike. And because that's the best way to be with when you're with those groups. And so I consider that phrase, do that the same with any corporate. I'm not trying to be corporate-ish. I'm trying to be corporate-like. I'm not trying to be sport-ish. I'm just trying to be sport-like. And so that's one, that's meeting them where they're at. Because if I come in and immediately try, I'm like, all right, this is where you need to get to. These are all your failings and this is how to fix it. That's never fun. It's like, how do I scaffold the experience so that I can maximize learning?
Yes.
Experiential education, and for listeners, like experiential education is like the umbrella term, and it's like creating an experience and educating based on that experience. Adventure is like a subcategory of that. It's like an adventurous version of an experience. So what you're doing, where it feels like adventure light, you're doing an experiential education with an element of adventure in there, because there's the unknown, right? The further you get up that, the more adventurous it is. It doesn't mean you're not still having an experience. What I really look at is how can I create an experience that maximizes education, rather than having, because I think the mistake that I see a lot of people do is they try to like set up an experience and say, we're going to learn from this. What I like to say is, what is the experience I can do where they will learn the most? And I don't have to be the one who keeps saying like, this is how to do it. Like, how can I create moments that is going to, you know, spark their own ability to be creative, their own. So it might be setting up, like you said, a mystery box where there is some creativity. It might be giving someone a framework and letting them run with the framework. So as I look at your challenge, there's a framework that I often teach. It's called the ABCDEs of problem solving. I often tell people that that's the alphabet. I never made that part up. But A stands for analyze. And so you're analyzing, asking questions, trying to figure out what your problem is. So as I looked at the mystery box, I would be asking tons of questions, potentially trying to find loopholes. Like, that's a classic experience where you'll get people who's like, hey, what about if I do this? And then you realize that's a rule you could and should have added before. They've created a new rule for you. So B is then brainstorming, like coming up with ideas, like give them time to do it. I try to encourage people to do it away from the actual task, so you don't get like caught up in that experience. Plan away from the thing you're doing. And then C is choose. So choose one of the ideas. And that comes with consensus building, which I think is really important. Like, I'm very clear with the group that the choice you're going to make has to be agreed upon by all parties. And agreeing on something doesn't mean 100% agreeing. I typically say the 80-20 rule. If you agree with 80% of it, then disregard the 20 you don't and just take part.
Move on.
And then the D is the do it part, like actually try it. And then the E is evaluate. And so then you go through that. And then if you could evaluate that it didn't work and go back to brainstorm, you realized you didn't know everything, go back to ask. But if you can give them that structure, it doesn't matter what age, I think structures help. Another book for you, so you can add it to it. I read a lot, is a book called the Checklist Manifesto by Dr. Atul Gawande. He was like the Boston surgeon at the Boston General Hospital. He was like chief surgeon or whatever. But he talks about, and it sounds like a really utterly boring read on checklists, but it just talks about checklists are there for everyone. And if you can have systems and straight frameworks, and use them. The reason that medical people don't lose their gloves, jewelry in people's bodies, or they less than they used to, it's because there are clear checklists, right?
Like, yes.
It doesn't matter. You could be the smartest doctor in the world and you don't want to make a mistake. And that's where I think like people who have been in an intact group and maybe a leadership role for a long time, that's the mistake they make, is relying on their previous experience and forgetting, like, just go through the checklists. Doesn't matter if you've been doing it longer. I actually think it's better if people who are doing it longer care more about checklists than the people at the start who can make mistakes.
Yeah.
But like, if you give a framework such as the ABCDEs and then give them your mystery box activity, then that gives them a method to be able to go back to that very basic language that I would teach kids and remind them that I think the huge mistake that adults make, and I'm equally fallible of this, is assuming that I know it all already.
Yeah.
I actually think that's why kids are better at this stuff. Like,
I think you're
when
right.
it comes to problem-solving activities, kids don't have all that bias and that past experience and the care and the... They make mistakes willingly.
Yeah.
Adults make mistakes begrudgingly.
Yeah.
And that is a completely different outlook. And if you can get adults to make mistakes willingly, well, that's... Then we've already solved a lot of the issues, because then they're willing to actually go through and figure stuff out.
The nice thing about the experiential learning is when the mistake happens, everyone sees it, because you're not mm-hmm. asynchronous. You're physically yeah. there. Where in yeah. business, when the mistake happens, it's easy to like tear up that piece of work and not ship yeah. it or not share the learning moment of it. And I mm-hmm. think that hurts teams. Day in, day out, is that
absolutely
you don't see that willingness to not only make the mistake but share the learning moment. And so everyone's kind of going back to that safety word that you talked about, they're kind of, you know, seeking security and only showing their best work, and you just lose so much.
The comfort zone is not a bad space, and I think that sometimes we try, like, there used to be a phrase, there's a funny video, it was like an old commercial for Outward Bound. Mm-hmm. Showed a kid about to rappel off a cliff, and the kid was like, "No, I don't want to go." And then it showed the boot of the instructor kick the kid off the cliff, panned yeah. to the instructor, and he said, "I push kids out of their comfort zone," or something like. And it's like, that was the mindset, right? That's the way to help people. Comfort yeah. zones are designed to protect us, and they're legitimate good things, right? But if we want people to grow, then getting them out of that requires us to create the space, the safe space, to feel like they can. So yeah. when I talked about that comfort in all of these, it's like, how do you build that before you ask them to step out of it? And if you're asking them to step out of it before they've even built it, then you're not going to have that work. It's going to
that's a cool
go counter to what you want it. So it's like, that's where it goes back to that pre-work. Like, how do I build people to be comfortable? So then when I ask them to do something, like if I got asked by a client right now, if they called me up and said, "Phil, I'd love to work with our group to focus on connection, and you've got an hour to do so," I would tell them no. You just know that you can't shortcut that stuff. Like, it has you have to put the time, and it has to be something that you're willing to spend a lot of time in building comfortability. And then once you've got people comfortable, then guess what? You can ask them to go anywhere, because you as a leader have demonstrated this is a safe space to do that. And if the only experience that they've ever had is reprimanding behavior because they've done something wrong, whatever that might be, I think it's like psychologically safe learning environments are those environments where people have a lack of fear of repercussion. And repercussion could be in any form, right? Like, it doesn't have to be like you lose your job. It could be like people make fun of you. That could be in an adult environment. That's equally as jarring as it is in the kids' world. You don't want to be made to look stupid in front of your peers.
Correct.
So, like, if you can create an environment where none of that is, there was a German facilitator. Well, she's based in Germany, but she's not German. She's originally American, called Romy Alexandra.
Right.
She talks about mining opposite experiences. And I love the framing of that. Like, if you're working with groups, it means that you're not asking all the time when stuff is excellent. You ask them for the, like, if I did an activity and I said, "Who loved that?" You get a show of hands. "Woo, yeah, great." But then I say, "Who hates it?" And then I would celebrate people saying they hated it. Like, you mine for the opposite. And if
I
you get
that.
In the habit of mining for the opposite, then you're more likely to get dissent in your ranks. And that's not a bad thing. As I've said to you before, this is like, the critic is the greatest optimist, because if someone doesn't like something, that demonstrates that they care and they want it to be better. And we look down upon someone who's saying that they don't like it. And they're like, "Get out of here. If you don't like this," you know, there's negativity centered around the idea of saying you don't like something. Whereas I try to empower people to say that they don't like something, and that's okay. And I have to get my ego out of the way.
And it's not just because you're a whiny pom.
Yeah. Exactly. For me, that's true.
It's funny, like, having grown up in Australia and then moved to England and become English, my family always give me grief on that. They're like, "Oh, you went and became a whiny pom." So for any listeners here, the Australians always had this view that the British would complain a lot. But
and of course, the Aussies were criminals. We all know that too.
Still so much truth there. But what's fascinating there, Phil, is with what you shared about, you know, mining for the opposite, inviting that dissent. I saw a good friend of mine, Jeremy, sent me this post the other day about the complaint commitment cycle. Have you seen that one?
No, I don't think I have. Wow.
It's brilliant. Okay. It's building exactly on this thing. Mm. It's like, go out and find the complaints, find the critics, because that means that on the other side of their complaint, there is a passion and an energy to commit to something new that might be good for you. And it's just like, oh, that's awesome. So whenever a team member now brings a complaint to me, I'm like, rather than, well, I don't know that you're absolutely seeing that the right way, can you share more? It's like, okay, so that's your complaint. What would you commit energy and time to do to solve that? Like, what do you see as different?
Yes.
You don't have to sign up for it. You might be like, oh, I see where you're going to go, but we can't do it because... But I just think it takes the pressure out of that conversation, and it may open your eyes to something that could be done now or could be put in the parking lot and you can come back to later.
The motto at High Five Adventure, the organization I work, is connect, empower, lead, be the example. And so the empower word is like a critical step in the generation and the development of a leader, allowing them to empower them. But as you said, like if someone brings something up, like giving them the empowerment to make active change towards that, that's an empowering piece. And they get to demonstrate leadership quality. It also allows for you to be able to let go of some of the ego that you're feeling and the defensiveness that you might be feeling. And in reality, the people that we should be more concerned about in our organizations are those who are apathetic, those who don't care, those who are the status quo. You know, like, I'm just here for the paycheck, people. Like, and that's fine. They can be there. But those are the people who are negatively impacting culture, not the people who complain.
Correct.
And yet sometimes we assume, because we are defensive human beings, we're trying to protect ourselves. We said fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, right? Like we're all doing the same reaction, and it might be to fight. Like someone said that, I worked hard on that project and I think it's awesome. Or I came up with that rule and you're now saying it's a bad one. It's like those defensive instincts, we have to kind of shudder a little bit and just welcome in the critique, because that will ultimately benefit us.
Yeah. It's so interesting as I kind of weave through this conversation with you, Phil, there's these really important elements of teamwork that we're talking to. But one thing that you keep hitting from everything from your pre-work to mining for the opposite, expanding the comfort zone, there's a huge role still placed on the leader and or the adventure guide or whoever's playing that role in the moment. And there's something that I find really intriguing there. Because as you share some of these approaches, you know, how you might give the framework or otherwise, it makes me think right now leaders have to totally shift gears. They need to be moving more into this adventure-minded approach, because what has been in businesses, which have not ever been static, but they've been more like information, knowledge, reporting driven, is so much not the case right now. Like there is chaos everywhere you look right now. So I think the best leaders need to be the adventure guides right now is kind of the vibe that I'm landing on from everything you're sharing.
Absolutely. I would 100% agree. I think we interact with clients and we often call them our champions. And it's just because they have an adventurous nature about them. They have a willingness to be flexible, adapt to situations, not stagnate. Age has nothing to do with stagnation, although sometimes that might be considered the case. But like, no, some of the best leaders that I know are of people who have changed their minds in their later years. And it's just been like, nah, I got it wrong. And it's okay. Yeah. I was doing something that was for a generation that doesn't exist now. There is so much as we look at stuff. And I think that we're at this, the way I foresee team leadership development, the educational systems, we are at a tipping point. And it could be that maybe people 20 years ago were saying the same thing, but now that I'm in the age I am, I'm starting to feel it a little bit more. But I was talking to, I had an educational historian on the podcast, on my podcast, and it kind of illuminated me to some of the concerns that we have. We think about, you know, kids are going to become adults, they're going into the workforce, right? But what school, current traditional public school education is not setting them up for is the current work environment. Because what he actually referred to as the educational systems of today, he referred to not as traditional, but as industrialized education.
Yes.
So if you think about the you look at, really analyze the way that school systems are working in the public school environment. You've got the bells, you've got the order of how you walk down a hallway, you've got the structure of the desks. It was set up designing and preparing students to work in an industrial factory-based setting. The bells were the indicative of the bells in a factory. Like, there are, we don't have those factories necessarily as much anymore, but so we've forgotten about the pathway.
Yeah.
But the schools are still set up that way. The real original, you know, OG form of education was experiential. You figured stuff out by creating experiences and learning from those experiences. And we do it to this day. I'm shocked that experiential education, and I serve on, I'm the president of the board of the Association for Experiential Ed. And I'm consistently shocked that people don't know about us more, because everyone learns through experience. You're all doing it. Every single one of you listening tripped over at some point and you had a learning outcome from that. And now you lift your feet higher so you don't trip on roots, or you stare down, like everything. You touched a hot surface and you burnt your hand and you realized, oh, what's my reflection from that? Maybe I shouldn't touch that anymore. Like, we've all gone through it. And yet what we haven't done is now we've taken a school environment that's preparing kids for a new work environment that doesn't exist. And so we're shocked by a younger workforce who are not adaptable and don't have the flexibility that we are looking for on our leaders. But where was the preparation for them? And it wasn't there. So it's on leaders who are listening to this, as long as any person in a workforce, to realize that, not to complain about a generation and say, well, nowadays they don't have a work ethic or whatever you might hear. That we actually might need to adapt too. You know, like, we haven't got it figured out. Adults don't have all the answers. In the same way that I teach emotional regulation to my kids, I teach emotional regulation to the teachers I educate.
Yeah.
We are fallible human beings, and we haven't got it figured out, and we have to be more adaptable. And that means we have to accept and embrace adventure in our everyday, whatever that is. And it's just, once again, redefine adventure for yourself. You are experiencing adventures, and then just figure out what the learning outcome is and grow.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a good capstone to this great conversation, Phil, because I think being mindful of the workplace that we have right now, the people that we're bringing into it, how we're choosing technologies or social practices is really important for any leader, for any shareholder, for any parent. And I love what you've been able to share today. If any of our listeners want to, you know, jump onto the Vertical Playpen podcast or learn more about, you know, doing some experiential learning and adventure-based learning, maybe they're not quite chasing the Stanley Cup, but they do want their teams to be performing at the next level or overcoming a big strategic objective or milestone. How do they find you?
Yeah, they can find me. I'm on LinkedIn, Phil Brown, and it's Phil Brown High Five, H-I-G-H, the number 5. The organization is High Five, H-I-G-H, the number 5, adventure.org. And the podcast is in all places that podcasts are. So you can just search Vertical Playpen Podcast. And if you're listening to this one, it's an easy jump for you. You're already halfway there.
That's awesome, Phil. Well, I've really had a blast today. There's so much that you share that kind of weaves into some big themes for me and my life and for what I'm seeing in teams. So thanks for all you've shared. And I look forward to getting on an adventure with you sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Dane.
Thanks, mate.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, If you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on The Future of Teamwork.